Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program. It's a pleasure to have you here today for what I think is going to be a very interesting panel on a very interesting topic, Iran and Venezuela, where there has been much commentary and in general, I think, lack of information. So this will be very interesting to examine this relationship from both the Venezuelan and the Iranian point of view. We have with us three outstanding scholars who are experts on Venezuela and on Iran. We're going to begin with Dr. David Myers. Because Dr. Myers has a plane to catch, he's going to give his presentation, and then we'll answer questions, and then we will go with Dr. Hart and Dr. Milani. So we'll, in essence, cover the Venezuela expertise side first, and then look at the issue from the Iranian point of view after that. Dr. David Myers is an associate professor of political science at Pennsylvania State University. He specializes in comparative politics, especially Latin America and the Andean region. He's truly one of the great experts in the United States on Venezuela. He studied in Venezuela at IESA in Caracas and the Raul Leoni Foundation in Caracas, received his PhD from the University of California in Los Angeles, and is an author on a very large number of important books and scholarly articles on Venezuela. So it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. David J. Myers.
Well, thanks a lot, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here. I must admit, the first time I went to Caracas, Iran wasn't even on the horizon at that particular time. I guess that shows that I've been around for a period of time. Anyway, what I want to do is to look a little bit at, just exactly where Venezuela and Iran are at this point. So I have some PowerPoints, and we can talk about, or I'll go through them, and then you can certainly ask me some questions here, and we'll see where we stand. Let me see if I can get it through. Anyway, that's a sort of an unlikely combination there. The leader of Venezuela and the leader of Iran. It's interesting, since Chavez was elected as president, of Venezuela, first time in he took office in 1999. He's been to Iran seven times, which is quite interesting. And Ahmadinejad has been to Caracas two or three times. So I think, in a sense, this was sort of an interesting thing for both of them. So the question is, what do we see there when we look at them? Because, you know, basically, you don't really think that there's going to be that much similarity between Iran and Venezuela. For example, the leader of Iran is a very devout Muslim. He talks about going into prayers every day, seeking guidance from Allah in all that he does. I don't think that prayer is a high priority for Mr. Chavez. I could be wrong at that point. I do know that he did start out. As more or less a Catholic, and then later on he became an evangelical Protestant until I guess it was Pat Robertson suggested the CIA take Chavez out. And after that, he really decided that perhaps evangelical Protestantism wasn't exactly where he wanted to be. And now he's sort of moved to Santa Rita. So anyway, there's quite a difference between between the two of them, but you know, when you get behind sort of the something like that, what you really find out is that in terms of the way they look at their domestic polities, there's actually some similarities between the two of them. Chavez started out presenting himself very much as a Democrat. And I did a lot of polling in 1998, and one of the things that I used to do with the polls, since I polled with a group that was allied with Chavez, I used to brief Chavez once every 3 or 4 weeks on the polls. And so I had a chance to interact with him at that time. And I must admit, my reading with him during that period of time was that he was very much a Democrat. What you've seen as, for a number of reasons, I think he's moved very much away from that. To some degree, I think he didn't really realize, or did not show what some of his true colors were. After all, he arrived on the scene as a somebody with a coup in 1992. Also, he had a real clash with President George Bush in up at Quebec, and I remember talking with him when he came back from that Quebec, and he and Bush went a little bit in one of their meetings as to what was involved with democratic and democracy, Chavez was talking about participatory democracy, and Bush didn't really know quite what that was. The end result was that the two of them didn't get along very well at all. The other thing, of course, that Chavez decided that the United States had a hand in the 2002 coup, and particularly after there was the clash with the middle class and the private sector in Venezuela, which tends to be very tied with the United States and the U.S. counterparts, Chavez moved further and further away from what at least he projected in the 1998 campaign was the treatment of dissent. And in that, in a sense, you see a lot of similarities between what Chavez will talk about as a type of democracy, which is, you know, participatory democracy, sort of moving toward what I would call dictatorship light. And I think you would also say that you see some of the same things in Ahmadinejad. In terms of how they're attempting to organize their countries, what you see is that both Chavez and the Iranians have certain reliance on military and revolutionary militias and guards to intimidate the opposition. I know in the referendum, which occurred in February, the day before the voting occurred on the path, which was, this was February 15th, 2009, so it's not that long ago, on the path where the opposition was going to march, Chavez had several of the Russian helicopters fly over the line of march, and then he had a number of these people with body armor that I think he'd gotten from the Russians. They sort of looked like the Ninja Turtles, but they actually walked around, and it was mildly intimidating. The other thing is that Venezuela traditionally has had access to the best public opinion polling in the United States, of course, no Americans are involved at all with Chavez now, but he does have Iranians doing some polling. He also has, of course, some people around him. What was fascinating is that, remember, Ahmadinejad had this thing, Ahmadinejad is love, which was nobody knew exactly what that meant. But with Chavez, of course, it could take on a somewhat different meaning in the Latin context. But nevertheless, what Chavez had was exactly during the campaign, Chavez is love. In other words, you vote for Chavez and you're voting for love. Why do I put that up? I put that up because, once again, it shows that the people who are advising Ahmadinejad, the people that are advising Chavez, are really very much in communication with each other. So once again, it shows that, yes, there's elements of smoke and mirrors in the Iranian Venezuela relationship, but not totally. And another interesting thing where you see some similarities in the domestic is the use of elections to maintain legitimacy. Now, if you look at the new election law that Chavez is just put before the National Assembly, it has a lot of similarities to some of the election law that you see in Iran. So once again, you see similarities back and forth. Now, whether indeed the Iranians are sitting there and helping Chavez draft his law, I really don't believe that. I don't think that many people in Venezuela that can read Parsi anyway. But I have seen Iranian manuals in Venezuela, but translating them is another thing. What Chavez is attempting to do, and I think he wants to model the National Assembly elections of 2010, which will be next year. He postponed the municipal council elections, which were scheduled for the fall of this year. All of those have been postponed, and they're going to be rolled together into the 2010 election. And once again, the way in which the law is set basically is going to make it almost impossible for the opposition not only to control the National Assembly, but really even to come up with much more than 20%. And, of course, Chavez wants to keep the opposition below 25% because the National Assembly could block changes he wants to make. And, of course, he's attempting to making them for. So, in a sense, there's some similarities there in that having elections which would actually change quote, the revolution, whether it's Amajinadad's revolution or whether it's Chavez's revolution, I think the two of them share a type of interest at that particular point. So let's look at some other types of interests that they have that go different than what their interests on the polity are. Once again, Iran is, you know, is isolated in many ways. The U.S. is making a major effort to isolate Iran. Chavez is not isolated near as much. But once again, I think what Chavez is able to do with Iran is to lessen the type of isolation that Iran has. He's been very favorable toward the activities, at least in statements that he's made, of Hezbollah and the type of thing that Hezbollah has done in the Middle East. What he's also done is he's attempted to interchange technology that Venezuela has and Iran has in order to get what the Iranians have that he doesn't have. But more importantly, in some ways, he's also, remember, you've got some of the most important petroleum companies down on the Faja Orinoco, which has this very heavy petroleum. So there's a lot of technology there that can be transferred even to Iran, even though Iran itself doesn't have the heavy technology. The other thing is that opposition to the United States, well, we also have the military thing, and I'll talk a little bit about that next. But clearly, when Chavez has reorganized the military and the national security component, he's modeled it on some of the national security reorganization that you've seen in Iran. And I'll go into that in a little bit. But in terms of opposition to the United States, Chavez just made the statement as he, remember, there's quite a clash over the bases in Colombia, the Manta base in Ecuador, which was closed by the United States, which closed by the Ecuadorians, by Correa. The United States negotiated three bases in Colombia. Chavez very much opposed to that, attempting to break out of isolation. The Iranians made statements supporting that, and Chavez then, when he finished and thanked the Iranians for their help, basically said the United States is the evil empire, not only evil empire, he said the most evil empire that has existed in the history of the world, and the world will never be safe until the United States is no longer a powerful country. Well, in that, I think he and the Iranians have a certain amount of concern. The other fascinating thing, we were talking a little bit about this before we came, Chavez has an extreme dislike for American consumer culture, very much like the dislike that you see in the Iranian Revolution. And you see that, for example, in the way he deals with women. He has brought women into leadership positions, but, for example, Cecilia Flores, who is president of the National Assembly, no makeup. They're supposed to wear very non-revealing clothes. And in other words, there is a very strong attempt to equalize the sexes, which is part of Chavez's deal, which is not exactly part of the Iranian thing quite a bit. But nevertheless, the dress is very much the same, because you don't want women with lipstick, you don't want them with makeup, and he actually prohibited the bringing of makeup into Venezuela, particularly lipstick for a period of time. So there's this very strong dislike of American consumer culture. And Chavez will point out the number of people that drive to work in the United States, and there's only one person in the car, talking about how this is totally unacceptable. So once again, this is sort of a sharing of some interests that he has with the Iranians. In terms of the softening of isolation, it's interesting. Chavez, as I said, made 7 trips to Iran since 2004. And remember, 2004 is pretty critical in terms of the Iranian-Venezuelan relationship, because in August of 2004, there was an attempt at a recall referendum. And remember, this was the time when the middle class really went after Chavez. And Chavez won that referendum, and once he won the referendum, he began to isolate the middle class, and part of the isolation of the middle class was moving toward the Iranians. What you have, I think Ahmadinejad has been twice, maybe 3 times to Caracas. What he has is he signed 30 different agreements with the Iranians. You get things like truck factories, ammunition factories. Very interesting. The ammunition factories are used to make ammunition for some of the Kalashnikov rifles that he got from the Russians. And it was very interesting. If you look at the type of ammunition that was done, he could have done 2 types of ammunition, one which is the more modern type, which has better range and better accuracy. The other is the older type, which the guerrillas have. A lot of the guerrillas in the Andes have weapons that fire this type of a bullet. And so Chavez wanted the type of, the older type, which, you know, you can draw any conclusions you want about that. But some of them are somewhat obvious. Also, the Iranians are building cement plants anywhere. If anybody perhaps knows why the Iranians are building cement plants everywhere, I've never been able to figure that out. But they have one that's actually going on. The other thing, of course, what you have is you've now developed flights. There's one flight a week going from Caracas to Damascus and Damascus to Tehran. They use 747s. They gave them old 747s. I don't know. Given the Venezuelans' ability to do preventive maintenance, I would be very dubious about taking an old 747 on a flight to Damascus, but who knows. What you also get on isolation is you get Venezuelans' very strong expression of support for Iran to develop nuclear energy. And this, of course, flies in the face of some of the United Nations and resolutions. The other thing is because Venezuela has formed what's called the ALBA Alliance, which is the leftist states in Latin America, and this is what you get Nicaragua, you get Cuba, you get Ecuador, you get Bolivia. The question is not quite so much. In Argentina, but when Chavez brings and gives support for Iran's right to develop nuclear weapons, what he's able to do is also bring the other ALBA countries around. So this, in a sense, helps Iran break out of the isolation that comes from some of the things of the, some of the resolutions of the United Nations. Financial. This is fascinating. Remember, we have holds on the Iranian situation, the Iranian financial community. In 2008, the Iranians were able to purchase a large bank in Venezuela called the Corp Banca Compañía Anónima. It's interesting that the paperwork, which, you know, in Venezuela can be very slow, this went through in record time. The Iranian board of directors, contrary to a lot of the Venezuelan laws where you're supposed to have a majority of Venezuelans on the board of directors, they have almost all Iranians, I think only one Venezuelan on this. What this, of course, allows, since there are not there is no freeze on Venezuelan assets, this allows the Venezuelans to transfer money into the United States. It allows them to, for any purpose that they want, it's very difficult to keep records of it. It also allows them to transfer money from the all throughout Latin America. And of course, there's a lot of Hezbollah cells which are funded down at what's called the Three Corners area, where Brazil, Paraguay, and in Argentina come together. And there's been a lot of ties back and forth in that. The other second bank, which is interesting, and once again, we don't know so much about this because this came in April 2009. This is the Iranian Venezuelan Development Bank. And this bank has an initial capital of $200 million. It's supposed to go up to $1.2 billion, with half of the capital coming from Venezuela and half of it coming from Iran. It's supposed to be for infrastructure development. There's been a lot of speculation, and the Israeli intelligence have argued that some of this is going to be related to allowing the Iranians to do and the Venezuelans to do uranium mining. There's something like, would it be 50,000 kilotons or something? I'm not an expert in uranium, but a large, significant store of uranium exists in Venezuela. The Israelis have already claimed that some of the uranium from Venezuela has gone into the position, into the Iranian program. And, of course, one of the things that Chavez wants is he wants to have a nuclear plant of his own. And he's done negotiations both with the Iranians and also with the Argentinians. So far, he hasn't been able to get that. So, but anyway, this whole thing of the Iranian Development Bank, the Iranian-Venezuelan Bank, a lot of this is speculation up to the present point because we really don't know how far they go. Military cooperation. This is very interesting to see. Once again, you see that things begin to move after the 2004 referendum, because the 2004 referendum in Venezuela, the recall referendum, when Chavez won it, he's beginning to move more and more away from an open democracy and more towards controlling things. What you have during this period of time, they embedded military in all the Venezuelan, well, not all of them. We don't know. I mean, I wasn't out there with the Venezuelan military units, but we do know that a number of military advisors were embedded inside the Iranian units. The other fascinating thing is that Chavez has developed a number of militias, and these militias are modeled on the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. And what you have is you have something in Venezuela called the Francisco Miranda Front, which is a group of young people that go around Venezuela. They're somewhat a shadowy group. Some people have even compared them to Hitler's brown shirts. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. But they're very much in terms of helping Chavez people organize the country and organize the communities, the localities, the community councils. And once again, these Iranians, advisors from the Revolutionary Guard, are actually embedded into the militias. It's interesting that in last March, the Iranian defense minister did come and had a very long meeting, brought quite a large delegation with him. And once again, I was not privy to any of those particular meetings. But nevertheless, out of that, there was a statement issued after that where Chavez talked about a new level of coordination between the Iranians and the Venezuelans. Now, what that means, your guess may be as good as mine at that. One of the interesting things here in terms of what they're going to do with the money and so forth, and I throw this up because it's fascinating. When Chavez took over, he began to establish control over the military. At that time, most of the high command in the Venezuelan military had been trained at even Fort Leavenworth or at the Army War College or at the National Defense University here. They used Spanish translations of American field manuals. What Chavez had is he had them in 2005. He closed down the Superior War College in Los Choros, had them burn all the American manuals, and they actually had some Iranian manuals that they translated. One of the things that he did is this book, I don't know whether any of you have seen it, by Alain Jouxet, called La Guerra, United States, Iraq, Imperial Guerra Asimétrica y Chaos Global. What you see in this book, it's an attempt to say that, look, in Baghdad, the suicide bombers have had a lot of success. We now have found the tool that we can bring the empire down with. And as I said, Chavez always refers to the he always refers to the United States as the empire, the evil empire. So this book was circulated over a lot of anti-U.S. Places in Europe. The Iranians use it. They've translated it and give it to their people. Chavez had excerpts from this translated, and as he redid the Army field manuals, every Venezuelan officer had some of this translation of this book on asymmetric warfare. And indeed, when the War College opened at Los Choros in Caracas afterwards, the whole curriculum for the lieutenant colonels and the colonels it was how you actually can manage asymmetric warfare, which basically what Chavez's position was, as I understand it, is, look, the United States is going to eventually invade Venezuela and try to get the oil because of the tremendous amount of oil that exists there. And there's no way that we can actually resist an American invasion using conventional military forces. So what we'll do is we'll let them come in, we'll sucker them inside, just to what happened in Iraq, and then we'll go ahead and we'll attempt to use asymmetric warfare against them. He's also talked about having the capability to use asymmetric warfare in terrorism against the United States. In this, he's talked a little bit about the possibility of being able to train suicide bombers to come across the southern border, come up through Central America at that point. Now, this was interesting because the last 2 days I've been at a conference at National Defense University, and we're looking into a number of things about security threats to the United States in the Caribbean Basin. And one of the things that the Mexicans were talking about is as the drugs are coming up out of the Andes up through Central America, they're not coming up so much through the Caribbean right now, that the Mexican intelligence relies very much on human intelligence, somewhat even on ties with people that are into the cartels. And it crosses, you know, money crosses their hands. That's what the Mexicans rely on. Well, this is, once again, this is speculation. As I said, when you're dealing with this issue, which is very difficult to get into, you just raise some questions. I mean, the money that is now available in the Venezuelan financial system that comes from Tehran and from the Iranians. I mean, the Iranians are in a situation where they don't have a lot of money to throw around. So when they're throwing around billions of dollars in the Venezuelan banking system, you have to ask the question is, what is it for? Well, one thing that happened, remember we had the raid across the Colombian border into Ecuador. And they found a number of hard drives and things from Raul Reyes. I mean, there's some evidence that we figured out where Reyes was. We'd never known before because Chavez called Reyes on his cell phone, and we tracked it with NSA. But I'm not particularly sure about that. But what was interesting when they went through the camp? First of all, there were Iranian field manuals with the FARC. There definitely were Iranian field manuals and translations. They also were able to, based on what was on the hard drive, and of course this is things that are released. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff on the hard drive that was never, that's classified. But they were able to find a discussion that where $480,000 in cash was hidden in Costa Rica. And they went to that place in Costa Rica and they found the $480,000 in cash. So once again, that gave some validity to that. The other thing is they found 30 kilos of low-grade uranium. What I'm told, once again being a social scientist and not a real scientist, people tell me that the type of uranium that they actually found was really of such poor quality it probably couldn't be put into even dirty bombs, let alone weapons-grade uranium. And basically what people feel is that somebody had snookered them on a deal with uranium, and they didn't want to admit that they'd been snookered, so they buried the uranium. But the interesting thing is that based on what was on the hard drive, they were actually able to find where the uranium had been buried. And once again, there was a lot of evidence on the hard drive of ties going through Venezuela off to the FARC, so that's important. Okay, when all of this is finished, you know, there are really two critical questions that I suppose U.S. policy leaders have to make. What is Iran's capability to influence conditions and events in Latin America that have an impact on the United States? Now, yesterday there were really basically two positions when this came up at the National Defense University when we talked about it. One group said, look, this is all smoke and mirrors. There's nothing there. Other people seemed to think that there was a little bit more than that's there. I would argue there's at least enough there that it bears watching. And there is certain element between Iran and the Venezuelans where they can use each other. The Iranians really have some doubts, like many people have, about the Venezuelans to pay attention to detail and actually to get things done. Nevertheless, you know, there's enough there that you need to think about it. So once again, should the U.S. be concerned about this? Is it a major national security threat? My own feeling is I don't think it's a major national security threat, at least not at this particular point. Nevertheless, it seems there's enough there that indeed one needs to keep an eye on it. And I think the prognosis is that the ties between Venezuela and Iran are going to be strengthened in the future, not weakened. And so where that goes, I don't know. No crystal ball up here. Okay, pretty much that's what I have. Peter?
Thank you very much, Dr. Myers. There's time for about two questions, perhaps, if anyone has a question for Dr. Myers. Before he leaves?
Yes.
Sir. If you could please state your name, please, and your affiliation, the gentleman here in the front row.
Thanks. My name's John Atchley. Oh, I'm sorry. I used to be assigned to the embassy in Caracas as the petroleum attaché. And I was married to a Venezuelan for many years, and I've been back and forth. My impression is Chavez is a personality difficult for Americans to understand because he's messianic and believes he's the reincarnation of Bolivar and he wants to liberate the Andes and he's not going to stop. He was very dangerous back in the 80s when he was a low-level military officer with little cliques that got together and discussed things, and my understanding was that the chief of staff of the armed forces back then asked Carlos Andres Perez to get rid of him. Unfortunately, Carlos Andres Perez's ego got in the way and he said, no major can ever be a threat to me. And Chavez launched an armed coup while he was in uniform against the government. People tend to forget that. They call the 2002 effort by civilian groups to basically pressure him out without armed violence a coup, but they forget that Chavez ran a coup. But I don't think he's ever going to give up. And I think it's like I'm trying to understand Hitler. You said there was a comparison, but not very great. But he has a way to motivate people, and he has a temperament that it's very hard for us to understand. I don't think we're going to do anything because we get oil from Venezuela. We don't have enough money or forces or time or attention to open up some other front. But I do think he's going to be very, very dangerous. I think he's going to be a thorn in our side for a long time, and he'll do whatever he can to hurt the U.S.
Do you have a question?
Well, I feel there's more to the background. I think he is a more serious threat because of the psychological temperament, and I'm not sure whether... I'm not familiar with what the U.S. can do, but you've been talking to some of the defense people. You said that they're split, but is there anything the U.S. can do?
Well, at this point, you know, options are pretty well limited. The U.S. is pretty well overextended in a number of things. As long as we're – I mean, one of the things that's happened is the Chinese have come in and Chavez is trying to sell oil to the Chinese. He's trying to reduce dependence on the U.S. And there are only so many places that you can refine Venezuelan oil. And one of the places is the refinery in Aruba. And the Chinese and Chavez together are taking over that refinery, reconditioning it. That will allow him to reduce some dependence on the U.S. I mean, you know, Chavez's personality, it's interesting. If you if you talk with Chavez, he does have this messianic tie to him. Remember, one of the first things he did is he offered the French to take back Carlos the Jackal. The Carlos the Jackal's brother is one of Chavez's advisors. And the French were not about to release Carlos the Jackal to Chavez. But Chavez also has in his office, he has this letter from Simon Bolivar, which was written when Bolivar was near the end of his days, but he talks, it's called El Delirio de la Chumborazo. And it's very interesting because in this, Bolivar talks about that he only feels like he really lives if he's in a conflict, that he has to be in a conflict, he has to have an enemy, he has to be doing something. And I think there's an element of that, that's into Chavez. He has to be involved in some sort of a large struggle. He's not going to be content to only take the oil from Venezuela and use it to develop to Venezuela, because he just hasn't done that. I mean, if you look out to Caracas, the infrastructure is breaking down because he's putting oil all over the country. And I mean, this partially explains, I think, getting back to what we're doing now, the ties with Iran, because Iran gives him some more force to be a bigger thorn in the side of the United States, and I think that's part of his motivation.
Okay, I think we're at the point where you have to, according to the time you told us that you had to leave for the airport, you were there. So
yeah. When I was at NDU, they gave me a flight that I couldn't change, so I'll
anyway,
have to get it.
So anyway, so, but thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
very
you, David.
Much.
We'll now move to our other two panelists. Dr. Joanne Hart is a professor at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she teaches Middle Eastern history and courses on technology and education. She's also an adjunct professor at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. She's taught at Barnard and Columbia University, the Naval War College. She received her doctorate in political science at New York University, and she's a specialist on, as I said, on the Middle East and on Iran. Dr. Hart.
I very much appreciate the invitation to be here today. It's an important subject, and I very much appreciate being on the panel with both David Myers, who I have to learn a lot about Venezuela from, and my very esteemed, knowledgeable colleague on Iran, Dr. Milani. So I wanted to begin with probably an obvious point, but that the June 12th election in Iran was unequivocally fixed. So there's no doubt about that. There's no question on that. And now what may be less obvious is that the crisis that's developed in the aftermath of that fraudulent June election is not one that the Islamic Republic is likely to recover from. Not immediately, and it may take a protracted period, but I believe that the clerical rule as we know it in Iran is finished. I agree with the characterization that I've seen that it's a tectonic plate shift underway in Iran. The fundamental legitimacy of the regime is challenged now with unprecedented breadth and depth. So that's essentially, of course, a domestic crisis, which, oh, by the way, gives us yet another unstable state in an already very turbulent area and war zone, if we think about what's on either side of Iran. And so, of course, we have key questions about Iranian foreign policy. What does all this mean for foreign policy, particularly as it relates to the nuclear program, possible weaponization of nuclear fuel, and, of course, its ability and willingness to negotiate with the U.S. or the international community, but the U.S. at the lead on that. So I'd say that's the big picture. I'm finding it quite consuming to understand or try to understand the dramatic current situation in Iran, what's happening there every day. And there's a certain amount of what I think of as criminology involved among specialists, all the kinds of watching. It's very reminiscent of when the Politburo would come out and there's all this attention to who's standing who next to who. And we have that this week. We had the inauguration of Ahmadinejad's second term, and there's down in the weeds, there's all kinds of interest in, did Ahmadinejad kiss the cheeks of the supreme leader? No, he didn't. And who came, who boycotted the inauguration? And there's lots of inside baseball now on the potential lineup of the vice presidents for Ahmadinejad. So there's a lot. I don't propose at this point to go into much of that kind of detail in this overview comments, but of course we can return to some of that during the discussion if there's an interest in that. But what I do want to do is put several observations on the table for us to look at and then follow up on. First is to characterize the current situation. It's very important that it's both what's happening in Iran now is both an elite and a popular, has elements of both a elite issue and a popular dynamic. It's the division of elites is something I do want to say more about. It's very significant. In one way, it's the elites have always been divided in the history of the Islamic Republic. It's been a very fluid situation, always shifting. That's been endemic. But it's never been so severe as it is now, so visible and so widespread. Now the divisions within the leadership and within the religious establishment are at the forefront. And, of course, that's going to have policy consequences, among other things. So there's certainly an elite angle, but it is not only that. And the popular discontent is truly widespread. And I don't think we can underestimate that element of the situation. It's not near something that's happening only in Tehran, or there's protests by only middle-class people or only students. It's far more broad-based, and it's larger numbers even than we can see from whoever comes out to protest or demonstrate in the streets. Part of that is based on Iran's demographics. You probably know that Iran has about two-thirds of its population under 30 years old. That's huge and significant for lots of reasons. And for one thing, this is such a youthful population. Most people weren't born for the revolution. And many or most were too young for the Iran-Iraq War. So this is their Kent State. This is their Woodstock. This is, for a lot of people, their politicized moment. And for that reason, I don't think this is going away. So far, the largest demonstrations were a few days after the election, where the Tehran mayor said that 3 million people were in the streets demonstrating. And part of the significance of that is it's often commented on that it's a wide, pretty extraordinary cross-section of society that are demonstrating. So again, sometimes I hear it characterized in the news as students or just young people. But of course, with two-thirds of the country young people, that you're going to see a lot of that. But it's also goes from young to old. A lot of women involved, this sort of from chadors to gelled hair and makeup and so on. So the cross-section, I think, is very significant here. And the demonstrators and this sort of weight of the revolt following the June 12th election, I think also reveals to us something about Iran that is significantly different than much of the Arab Middle East. And that's that political rights in Iran have been really fought for a long time, and people feel more or less entitled to them, that there's a deeply democratic current in the political culture, which isn't necessarily what we're used to thinking about Iran from the outside. But I think we can really see that in what happened after the elections were fixed and how immediately and huge the reaction was, that that's very revealing in itself. That also relates, for me, to the idea that political rights can't easily be traded away in Iran. That's one reason that makes me argue to you that this is going to be a problem that undermines the regime. The current crisis now, especially as the demonstrations have been suppressed and the government in Iran is clearly willing to use force, there's parallels that some people are drawing to the Chinese with the Tiananmen Square 20 years ago, that sure, there can be this kind of burgeoning movement, but it can be a moment if it's repressed enough. But I don't think that that parallel in Iran is an appropriate one, because Iran is not in a position to make a bargain with people about political rights in the way that China was, because Iran can't lead decades of sustained economic growth the way that China did. And in fact, the opposite is true for Iran. There's declining economic prospects. It's part of the problem. But they can't buy people off the way that in some success of the Chinese in that. However, it's very relevant in this that for the Iranian leadership and the regime, that there's a very high cost of suppression. And we really need to keep that in our attention in this issue too, because using force, brutality, abuse, that all weakens a government. And it's very costly. Obviously, the better alternative, having power and not having to use it is your best outcome. Having power and needing to use it is costly. So there's the outright use of force, but there's also problems for Iran, for the government, in trying to suppress some of the tools and the vehicles of opposition in Iran. The government literally can't afford to suppress the electronic means of communication over time. It's hugely expensive, and the government really doesn't have the resources to clamp down, as we saw right after the June 12th election. There was the suppression of cell phone and internet, but all this is very resource intensive. And Iran really won't be able to do that over time. And the technology itself is pretty interesting. It enables overcoming some of this suppression. There is a worldwide interest in helping Iranians get around the filters and overcome the cutoffs on cell phones and so on. And collusion, even implicit collusion, like keeping the channels open on Twitter. And we can say more about this in the discussion, but we've all seen the role of technology in the opposition. But I'm also noting that Iran cannot well suppress that. Beyond the use of technology as a tool that's been so successful for the opposition, it's very noteworthy that the opposition and this revolt, how we characterize it in different ways, but they've appropriated the language of Islam, the language and symbols of Islam, and that's quite powerful. It's very, I think, a very astute move by people that are protesting the government, because it can't as easily be assailed for their Islamic legitimacy, or they can't be written off as some fringe leftist or discredited the way they might if there were other other banners other than green. Of course, the opposition is the green movement, the green revolution, some people would say, but they have the rallying cry, "God is great." And that's, again, using the symbolism of the regime itself. And then that leads to the situation where members of the paramilitary, the Basijis, are firing on civilians that are chanting, "God is great." And that's an ironic situation that, of course, is very evident to Iranians, that a theocratic government that is supposedly protecting and promoting Islam is now in a position of suppressing a lot of religious observances, like attending Friday prayers, reading the opening chapter of the Quran, some observances for the dead, and this idea of being able to shout "God is great" at night from rooftops. And furthermore, Shia Islam itself gives the opposition some resources to draw upon for its protest. We see this in the 40-day mourning cycle. We just had that, I guess, last week for the young woman, commemorating the death of the young woman, Neda Aga Sultan. So there are patterns and rituals that can be well easily observed that bring people together. This can repeat and sustain a process of protest. We had that in the Islamic Revolution, and we're already seeing the signs of the readily available resources in Islam that the opposition can make use of. And that's, of course, at the ground or the grassroots level. But I think it's also important to say more about the elite divisions. Again, these are unparalleled. Of course, and you well know that the opposition includes two ex-presidents of Iran, Rafsanjani and also Khatami, which is quite important in itself to have that high-level division. But the religious establishment itself is also fairly deeply divided here. Ahmadinejad's election has been rejected or questioned by all but one of the grand ayatollahs in Iran. And the most important cleric, Ayatollah Montazeri, issued a fatwa declaring the Ahmadinejad administration illegitimate. There's an influential group of seminarians in Qom. They issued a statement demanding new elections. And even some hardline Ahmadinejad supporters have begun criticisms. And in general, there's a real question about the viability of Ahmadinejad's second term in office. Just getting a cabinet stood up is going to be a significant challenge, and the difficulties of getting things through parliament and so on. So the elite divisions are extremely significant here. I think there's two key, essentially nested issues to discuss in that Iran's economy and its oil prospects are both domestic issues, but they relate to foreign policy and some of the where the rubber hits the road for us here in the U.S. The economic descent of Iran is of critical proportions. I just don't think it could be understated. And particularly given the youth demographic, the state of the economy is one of the largest problems that Iran has, and it dovetails with this opposition. Just to give you some sense of the proportion of the economic crisis, the annual inflation rate is at least 26%. The official unemployment rate is at 20%, but unofficially the unemployment rate is more like 40%. And all of these economic figures are well up, or to say worsened significantly, under Ahmadinejad's first term. So the necessity to ameliorate the economic problem is huge. Related is oil. Iran is a major oil state and derives its significant revenue from there. We know we associate Iran with an oil-producing state. Iran has the second largest oil reserves in the Middle East. However, it's currently importing 40% of its gasoline. Likewise, it's a major has major reserves of natural gas, but it's importing natural gas. The infrastructure degradation in Iran is tremendous, and I think it's not just a national problem for Iran. I think it's an international problem, if not a security problem. The U.S. Department of Energy, not long ago, estimated that Iran has a declining rate of production for oil, which, given its great reserves and its standing, it should not be declining in its production of oil. But that gives us some sense of the state of the infrastructure in that country. And the U.S. Department of Energy estimated that Iran may get to zero oil imports, oil exports within the next 5 years. So I really want to underline this point. I don't see much about this in the news, and I feel like I don't understand why more alarm bells aren't going out about this. Within 5 years, Iran may have no oil to put on the international market. So, and actually, I wanted to raise the part of this with David Myers, and maybe some other people here would know about this, but I think that the great need of Iran's oil infrastructure does raise a link with Venezuela. And I know there's some contacts and infrastructure agreements, but I think there's a genuine I have a genuine question about whether it's possible for Chavez to really significantly help modernize Iran's oil infrastructure. I would guess that if they could, they would have been doing that already, but again, I can be enlightened from people here. Also on the oil issue, apparently the U.S. is considering an oil embargo of Iran, and that may just be the recipe du jour, and locals here will know far more about this than I do. But in terms of an oil embargo, there's several important ways that that's the wrong answer. Some oil calculations I've seen, again, they're probably specialists here who can do a better job of this, but if we suppose that Iranian oil production is 3% of world supply and the demand elasticity of oil is 10%, then if Iran's oil were removed from the world market, gas prices in the U.S. might go up 30%. And those are pretty modest calculations, I think. And that is just counting Iranian oil. About a fifth of the world's supply goes through the Straits of Hormuz. And if there was an oil embargo going on and there was conflict disrupting the flow of oil in through the Persian Gulf, gas prices in the U.S. would certainly go up. And it doesn't need to be explained here why that would badly affect attempts at global economic recovery. So the oil dynamics themselves, just the numbers, why I give you some detail, it doesn't make sense to me. And in general, the point of an embargo, part of sanctions, if sanctions were going to sufficiently moderate Iran's behavior, I think they would have already. It's also likely infeasible to embargo Iran's oil. It's partly because why we haven't done this before, partly because we need the oil, and it's been spoken about a little bit already, but it's also very difficult to actually have a successful oil embargo. For one thing, Russia and China are not likely to go along with this, and the U.S. doesn't control all the key pathways and the lines of communication. So basically, if this is a non-starter, then I think we shouldn't even be rattling it or raising it. The security problems that we can identify with the Iranian crisis, I think, are truly worrisome. And that's to say nothing of what we don't know and what we're not thinking about. But even on the list of things that we can identify, I'm very, very concerned about what can go wrong here. If the Obama administration sticks with the claim that it's made so far, that it's unacceptable for Iran to control the nuclear fuel cycle, then negotiations with the U.S. or with the international community, Qua community, then negotiations aren't really a serious offer, because there's a strong national consensus in Iran that Iran has the right to control the nuclear fuel cycle. There's enough national pride invested in this that trading it away, negotiating it away, must be a very good deal for Iran. And if the U.S. is not willing to lead that effort or agree to that effort, then that's not a serious possibility. We have to talk about Israel. In Israel, there's an apparent consensus that Iran represents an existential threat to Israel. I don't believe that's the case, and I would argue forcefully to you that anything preemptive that Israel would do against Iran would degrade their security. However, of course, Israel may take matters into its own hands, it may attack Iran, may go after the suspected nuclear sites. There's certainly a lot of discussion about that. The Obama administration appears to have bought some time on this issue, but maybe, from what I can tell, it may only be through later this year, which, given what's happening in Iran and the instability there, that's not enough time to get this resolved. Iran is a vulnerable, defensive, brutal regime that's currently in denial about its declining power, and it's in a deep economic crisis with a very weakened president. That's our situation. From that, we could infer that negotiations just aren't possible. It's not the right time in Iran, and it's too difficult politically in this logic, too difficult politically for the U.S., an illegitimate Ahmadinejad, the undeniable brutality and abuses of the regime, that it's politically too difficult for the U.S. But the most optimistic I can be for you is to suggest that in some essential ways, Iran and the U.S. need each other to resolve this problem, or at least to demote the tension in the relationship, that both need each other. Now, why do I say that? For Iran, well, I'll start with the U.S. For the U.S., because we can't go to war with Iran. We should not be taking any steps that would lead to a war with Iran. There's a whole list of good reasons, and we can talk about those in the discussion if you'd like. It's likely that a war with Iran would be worse than a war with Iraq, and a war with Iran is against the guidance of our military leaders. So we should not be taking any steps that will lead to a war. So that's what's in it for the U.S., I believe. For Iran, it would gain more from a resolution of its nuclear crisis than the continuing scapegoating and vitriol that's been ongoing, that's been in the past and now. And I say that because I think for Iran, again, given the economic picture that I'm laying out for you, global economic enfranchisement, which would be the deal for Iran, that kind of joining the global economy would lead to economic gain, and that would be something that Iran could viably bring home for resolving this crisis. It would enhance Iran's reputation. It could help with the situation at home. They need that economic gain. And in fact, I think anyone who's in power in Iran needs that economic gain, needs to join the global economic community, and I think Iranians well know that. So for naysayers out here who have maybe already stopped listening to me talk about the scheme of a negotiated outcome, I do want to point out that Iran has already presented to the U.S. a list of topics it was willing to negotiate over. The list had all the elements the U.S. would wish for, and I think this really bears noting. The list that Iran gave the U.S. was weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, accepting a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians, stopping military aid to groups against Israel, and stability in Iraq. So it was all there. Now, that was in 2003, and it was not pursued from this end of things at that time. Of course, you can tell me that 2003 is not 2009, and a lot's changed, a lot's different. 2003 also was not when Ahmadinejad was president. It was the former president. However, 2003 had the same political head in Iran, the same supreme leader, Khamenei, and he signed off on that offer to the U.S. then, and he is ultimately the arbiter of these things. He's much more significant than the president, and we still have that same leader from when this offer was put together. And I would submit to you that Iran has even more to gain now than it did in 2003 from trying to resolve this issue. My last observation is that the instability in Iran, the current crisis in this revolt, has escalated the hair trigger between the U.S. and Iran. And that dynamic is there, and it unfortunately has gotten worse. So, for example, a naval incident in the Persian Gulf, which, of course, there's a tremendous amount of traffic and warships in the Persian Gulf, some kind of incident between, let's say, an Iranian speedboat and an American warship, which has happened in the past, some incident like that could very easily and quickly escalate into a shooting war. So I'll stop here on that unhappy note, but underscoring how significant it is that we work on these problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joanne. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Mohsen Milani, Professor of Politics and the Chair of Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida in Tampa, as an expert in political science and Iranian affairs, has written more than 50 articles, books, chapters, encyclopedia entries about the Persian Gulf, Iran's revolution, Iran's foreign and security policies. He has also taught at Harvard, Oxford University, St. Anthony College. Has a very wide experience. It's a delight and a pleasure to have him here. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your introduction and for inviting me. It's a great honor to be here. It is also a great honor to be on the same panel with my good friend, John Hart, who is one of the best experts on Iran. Not only she is one of the best, she usually is very objective and very fair and quite knowledgeable about Iran. So I am doubly blessed to be here. What I would like to do today is to talk about the nature of Iran's relationship with Venezuela and then draw some conclusions from it in terms of what it means for the U.S. Bilateral relations between Iran and Venezuela began to improve after Chavez took over. But particularly after the 2002 coup d'etat. At that time, a reformist Iranian president, Khatami, was in power. He quickly and forcefully condemned the coup attempt and blamed the United States for the coup. And after that, I think relations began to improve. However, the decisive moment came when President Ahmadinejad won the elections in Iran about 4 years ago. And after that, I think the nature of the relationship somehow was somewhat changed. Both Ahmadinejad and Chavez are populist presidents. Both of them love the camera. And both thrive on making controversial and sometimes idiotic comments. But they have developed a very friendly relationship. And in many important issues, international issues, they seem to be on the same side. It is very important to contextualize Iran's relationship with Venezuela. In order to do that, you need to understand that Venezuela is not on top of Iran's priorities. If you think of Iran's priorities from A, and since I'm a professor, I can only use A, B, C, and D. If you think, and I don't give Fs, if you think in terms of A to D, A being the top of Iran's priority, I would say Venezuela is somewhere between a C plus and B minus, but no more than that. But more important than that is that at least until the June election of 2009, which, as you all know, was a very controversial election, disputed election. At least until that time, there was no consensus, factional consensus, about Iran's approach to Venezuela. Etamad Milli, which is a newspaper that is probably about to be shut down by Ahmadinejad, and is owned by Mehdi Karoubi, one of the four presidential candidates, wrote a piece about Iran's relationship with Latin American countries. And I think this is the summary of what a lot of people in Iran, within the governing elite, look at this developing relationship. Etemad Milli said that the presidents of Venezuela, Nicaragua, and others are, and I'm quoting, left-wing friends, good for coffee shop discussions, but not for setting our security, political, and economic priorities. I think that is accurate, although I am personally offended by the reference to coffee shop discussions, because I am a coffee shop freak and I spend most of my time in coffee shops. But I think you need to understand that there is a significant opposition to what Ahmadinejad has been doing in Nicaragua. Now, what is the nature of this relationship with this background? I would argue that it is impossible for you to understand the nature of this relationship until and unless you understand Iranian policy toward the U.S. Because without this, what Iran is doing in Nicaragua makes absolutely no sense. In other words, if I give you many bits of information about what Iran is doing in terms of investment, what Iran is doing in terms of cultural exchanges, without understanding the broader context, believe me, you cannot understand why it is important for Iran. Iranian policy, Iranian foreign policy in general, is extremely American-centric. Now, I have argued that Iranian policy toward the U.S. in general has three pillars. Number one is the survival of the regime itself. And number two, it is deterrence. And number three, it is a low-level competition with the U.S., essentially in the Middle East and Central Asia. Now, that deterrence component is where I think Nicaragua and Latin America becomes important. That deterrence element has a deterrence strategy of Iran has four important elements. And two or three of these elements are intertwined with what Iran is doing in Latin America and in Venezuela. Number one, of course, is Iran's nuclear missile policies. I don't have much to say about this, except if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them. The second part of this deterrence is to create spheres of influence. Iran has successfully created spheres of influence in Herat, in Afghanistan. It is trying to create a major sphere of influence in southern Shia-dominated part of Iraq. It already has created a powerful sphere of influence in Lebanon. It is in the process of creating a powerful sphere of influence, ideological influence, in Palestine with close relationship with Islamic Jihad and Islamic Hamas. And I believe it is trying to do the same thing in Latin America. Another important aspect of this deterrent policy is Iran's asymmetrical warfare and asymmetrical diplomacy. They know that they cannot deal with the U.S. on conventional ways, so they have been seeking different ways of dealing with the U.S. And one of the things they have done, and I believe they have done it successfully at least until June the 11th, before the election, is to offer a model of resistance to the United States. And if you read the literature that has come out of the Middle East, if you read, for example, the literature by Hezbollah in Lebanon, they always talk about this model of relationship and in a model of resistance. And in a second, I'll show you how this is being framed in Venezuela. And finally, the last element of the deterrence strategy is that because, again, Iran recognizes this huge power differential between the United States and itself, it is trying to increase its retaliatory capability against the U.S. in case of an attack on Iran. And that is why that the sphere of influence that I was talking about has not only economic dimension, but also has military, intelligence, and terrorist components to it. Now, having said all of this, now how do we look at what Iran is actually doing in Venezuela, and why is Iran so interested in Venezuela? What I'm about to say, I'll identify four or five factors. These are from Iranian perspective, not necessarily from perspective of Venezuela. Number one, I think Iran is trying to create an axis of unity, or if you want, an axis of anti-Americanism, or if you want to use a Marxian jargon, use an axis of anti-imperialism. The key, of course, is that Iran is trying to undermine U.S. interest. Iran believes that the U.S. is trying to undermine its interest, so it is trying to retaliate by undermining, at least on the ideological level, U.S. interest. Now, here is, for Iran, Venezuela is really the springboard from which they can penetrate throughout Latin America. Iran, of course, Cuba, to a lesser extent, but Venezuela is the country that Iran, I believe, Ahmadinejad, has chosen as the area where Iranian influence can expand. I think Ahmadinejad and Iranians felt that President George Bush was quite unpopular in Latin America, and that the leftist movements in Latin America, the populist movement, are on the ascendance, and therefore they try to take advantage of that and combine this with their own model of resistance against what they call world arrogance, or what Chavez calls empire. And finally, Ahmadinejad's foreign policy, unlike the foreign policy of Khatami, is based on aggressive diplomacy. In many ways, he believes that the best defense is a good offense. And that's what he has been doing. If you pay attention to what he has been doing in the Middle East and elsewhere, that's exactly what he does. So ideological compatibility, opposition to the U.S., not only in Latin America and elsewhere, is the one of the key elements of this relationship. The second component of this relationship is oil. I believe foreign policy of every country is intertwined with its economic objectives, and if you don't understand that part of the equation, you cannot make sense out of a foreign policy of a country. As you know, Venezuela and Iran were the founders of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and now they are fourth and fifth largest oil producers, and they have two things in common, and that's why they are so close, I believe. Both of them favor increased oil prices and lower production. Now, why is this important? It is important because within the OPEC, you have Saudi Arabia, which is the most important exporter of oil, who does not favor that policy. They are much more inclined to have increased production and not so much higher oil prices, because their population is about, depending on who's the statistic you follow, anywhere from 7 million to 15 million. Well, Iran's population is about 80 million. They need more oil revenue. And within OPEC, I think Iran and and Venezuela are trying to create a bloc to neutralize Saudi Arabia. And finally, Iran is interested in getting in investing in natural gas and oil with Venezuela, in Venezuela and with Venezuela. The third desire of Iran is to create what I call economic sphere of influence, although at a very, very low level. I think this sphere of influence has an economic dimension, also has an ideological dimension that I talk that religious dimension that I'll talk about in a second. The economic sphere of influence is essentially designed to provide investment opportunities for Iranian private sector as well as for the Revolutionary Guards. But much more importantly than that, and here comes again the American-centric part of the Iranian policy. Iran's closeness to Venezuela is in many ways designed to undermine American economic sanctions against Iran. Iran is trying to show that it is not isolated, and by developing good relationship with Venezuela, economic relationship with Venezuela, establishing banks, etc., in many ways it can defy some aspects of U.S. sanctions against Iran. You know that, for example, and I think one of the previous speakers talked about this, we know at least of two banks created, one of them purely Iranian capital, but the other one that was recently, I think in 2009, was opened, is the Iran and Venezuela Investment Bank. Again, in an era where the U.S. sanctions are crippling Iranian economy, if you can find a friend who's willing to allow you to invest in your in their country, or is even willing to create a bank, is a victory for the Islamic Republic. Iranian investments in Venezuela, I think, is not that significant. I asked my graduate assistant to do a week of research on what he could find, and he is a fantastic researcher and is very careful. And his conclusion and my conclusion, based on reading what he gave me, is that there is a lot of hot air and very little facts. There is more garbage about what Iran is doing in Venezuela than you can find about what Iran is doing in a lot of other countries, partly because Iranian experts have not paid attention to what is happening there. So people who have their own agenda have been spreading all kinds of nonsense about what Iran does, which is really a disservice to Washington, because if you don't have accurate information, you can't develop the good policy. But what I have been able to confirm is that Iranian investments or Iranian economic activities really falls into three categories. One is banking relationship, which is very, it's developing. It's about $200 to $300 million. Then there is Iranian investments inside Nicaragua. And then there are joint ventures. Iran investment in Nicaragua is cement, and in Venezuela. Iranian investment in Venezuela basically in cement, and the reason why cement is what the Iranians do is because that's one of the few areas they have advanced the technique, because construction is a key element of Iranian economy, so they're pretty good at that. There is no other reason. Housing is another area, and petrochemical is the third area for Iranian investment in Venezuela. Then there is cooperative ventures, and we know of Iranians' investment in and participation in tractors, in producing tractors. We also know of Venair, which is Iranian automobile manufacturing in Venezuela. I think the latest stat that I saw, they're producing about 20,000 cars a year. And finally, there is the bicycle, the Atomica bicycle, because the Americans or some people who were making observation about the factory believe that this is a nuclear enrichment, uranium enrichment factory, where in fact it was bicycle one, and therefore Chavez, who loves to make news, called it Atomica bicycle, and it is being used. So overall, I don't think the investment is that significant. Finally, the last part of that relationship is cultural, ideological, and if you want, terroristic activities. There, I have seen some evidence that Iran and Venezuela are exchanging students, that Iranian students are learning different languages so that they can come to Latin America. And the same thing is true about Venezuela. And there is also the controversy regarding Iranian support or Hezbollah support for various Venezuelan groups. There is a talk, and I have no way of confirming it. I'm just repeating what I have read, is that one of the tribes, the Vayu tribes, most of them have been converted to Shia Islam. I like to talk with them why they're doing this. And then there is, of course, that famous commander, Theodoro commander, who has converted to Islam, has a website, and it's a fascinating website if you want to waste your time. Now, finally, the last part of my presentation, which is probably the best part of it because I'm going to finish, is what does it all mean for the U.S.? You probably remember that there was a huge story a couple of weeks ago. I think it was in Washington Time, the Washington Post or New York Times, I don't remember, about this, the myth of that mega embassy in Nicaragua. Everybody talked about this huge embassy. And, well, according to what we know, most of it was hot air. It was nothing. And some people talked about it, then other people talked about the fact that they have heard it from someone else, and it had its own life. The reason why I bring this up is because, as I said, we have to be careful not to exaggerate what Iran is doing so that we understand what actually Iran is doing. A few years ago, Chavez and Ahmadinejad talked about this $2 billion strategic fund. Well, I've been following this. I don't think the Iranian parliament has approved a penny of it. So there is a lot of talk. As I told you, both Ahmadinejad and Chavez love the camera. And when you love the camera, you have to make controversial comments. Otherwise, the camera doesn't come to you. So you tend to exaggerate things. So I warn you to please be careful about what you hear so that you don't exaggerate what Iran is doing, so that you know exactly what Iran is doing. And I believe what Iran is doing in Venezuela should be of concern to the U.S. I don't think it is a national security threat. Again, in the scale of A, B, C, D, 4, if I have to rate what is the threat of Iran in Venezuela to the United States, I would say I would give it a C- at this time. But it does have the potential to become a much more serious threat. Finally, because Dr. Hart talked about what has happened in Iran in the past 2 months, let me just offer the following observation. I think, and that's only in relation to what Iran is going to be, Iranian policy toward Venezuela. I think we have entered into uncharted territory in Iran. If you would have asked me on June 9th or 10th, is Iran a stable government? And do I see any possibility of the collapse of the Islamic Republic? I would have said no, decisive no. Again, using my own scale, A, B, C, D, I would have said probably D. But things have changed. And I don't know. I honestly want to make a confession, and the confession that I do not know is a devastating confession coming from an academic, because we know everything. But I don't know what happened in the elections. I have no idea. And I've been following it as closely as every single one of you, if not more. I've spent hours. I don't know what happened. I don't know why we are going through this. I have some ideas, but I'm waiting for more information. I'm waiting for more facts. What I do know, and that's how it is relevant to Venezuela, is that Ahmadinejad is going to have a tough time in his second term, because he's going to have a tough time in terms of establishing his own legitimacy. Now, whether this election was based on fraud or not is for the historians to study and make a definitive judgment on. It doesn't matter for me. What does matter for me is that a significant portion of the Iranian population has questioned the legitimacy of that election. And in politics, perception is often more important than facts. Now, he has to reestablish his legitimacy. Whether he can do it or not, I don't know. Whether he can even survive, I do not know. But but what I do know is that in terms of his foreign policy and in terms of getting approval for what he wants to do in Latin America, in Venezuela, he is going to face a very belligerent Iranian parliament, which is very unlikely to allow him to invest more money in Venezuela or even to finish the promises he have made. Iran is going through, as Dr. Hart said, serious economic crisis, and the oil prices are plummeting. And I think it is very unlikely for Mr. Ahmadinejad to be able to get the approval of a very critical, of a very belligerent parliament to finance his ventures in Latin America. With that, thank you for listening to me, and have a good day.
Thank you, Dr. Milani. The floor is open for questions. Again, please state your name and your affiliation. The gentleman in the back.
Good morning, Dr. DeShazo. My name is Angelo Rivero Santos. I'm the Deputy Chief of Mission of Venezuela here in Washington. And I appreciate the objectivity and the honesty with which our doctors, former colleagues, I come also from the world of academia, have spoken. I had to run out after Dr. Meyer spoke because as a Venezuelanist, I have followed Dr. Meyer's career since I was a student. And I told him, I said, you know, and I only tell you this because I told him, because it would be inappropriate for me to have told him, or, I mean, to have told you without telling him. I say, Dr. Myers, I am so disappointed because your writings about Venezuela have always been based on facts. And you have admitted today that all you said was based on speculation. And I just want to share that with you because I have invited Dr. Myers to have a conversation with him because everything he said was based on speculation, information that makes the op-eds of the Washington Times and the Washington Post, but it would not pass the peer review of an academic journal. And I think Dr. DeShazo, Dr. Milani, and Dr. Hart would probably, despite the ideological differences we all may have amongst ourselves, would agree with that. That is just my comment. A point of clarification is that I was listening to Dr. Myers and Dr. Milani talk about Iran-Venezuela cooperation, and I wrote to my ministry. And they say to me that we have accords in energy, industry, economy, and health. And that, in fact, there are 84 projects. And these are facts. You can go to our website in the ministry of our foreign ministry, and you can see this. And I can tell you that 27 of them are in agriculture and cattle raising. I can tell you that 22, as I am told by my foreign ministry, are in the area of economic cooperation. 26 of them are in energy and oil. By the way, Dr. Myers did mention that Iran is in the Fahad Orinoco Belt, which is true, as are 33 other countries. And 29 of them are on issues that have been mentioned by Dr. Milani and Dr. Myers on finance and investment. So just a point of clarification that there are just not 30 but 84. And we will continue to promote our cooperation with Iran in things that are in our national interest because, as Dr. Milani mentioned, our relationship goes back to 1959 when we secretly met in Baghdad with Iraq and Libya to form the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And finally, Dr. DeShazo, I have a question. Dr. Milani, I wonder if you could expand on the meeting that took place last year in Tehran, in which I understand most of South America attended, including allies, Washington allies like Brazil and Chile. What came out of that meeting? What is Iran's priority in terms of its foreign policy with countries like Brazil and Chile? And whether, as you probably say, a lot of it is hot air and talk and not real investment. If you could expand on that, I think it would be helpful to me. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. DeShazo.
Thank you for your comments. Do our panelists care to comment? Dr. Milani?
Should I go there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much for your question. Thank you. Iran does not have a Latin American policy. Iran has Latin American policies because it's different from country to country. I think Iran's relations with the big and more advanced Latin American countries are essentially based on economic and commercial interests. And I think Brazil falls into that. There is also the cultural part that Pelé is a popular soccer player, and Iranians have this great admiration for Brazil. And sometimes these facts, these cultural issues play a very important role. So for Iran, Brazil is probably the most important Latin American country, and not only because of its size, of its sheer size, but also because of its history with nuclear, with enrichment activities. And as you know, the Israeli foreign minister was, Mr. Lieberman, was in Brazil a couple of weeks ago trying to convince the Brazilians to influence Iran to change its nuclear policies, which I don't think is going to work. And I was interviewed by BBC about this. They asked me what I thought about this move, and I said, look, if Russia and China and the U.S. and the European Union could not convince Iran to reverse its nuclear policies, it would be foolhardy to think that Brazil can do that. So Brazil is in a category of its own, but then you have Argentina, which again is a very important country for Iran, but because of what happened to the Jewish centers, the bombing of the Jewish center a few years ago, I don't think the relations are as good as they need to be. And then falls the rest of Latin America. And there, I believe, Iran is relying on Venezuela to spread its influence. And there, in those areas, I think ideology, hoping to develop strategic alliance. Remember now, I didn't say a word about strategic alliance between Iran and Venezuela. I was very careful about it. Although, if you look at Venezuelan foreign policy, they have taken some initiatives that have extremely pleased Tehran. During the Israeli incursion into Gaza, from what I understand, Chavez was extremely critical of Israel, and Iran welcomed that. Venezuela has, through Iran, is beginning to expand its influence. I gave my paper about the Iranian perspective, how Iran is using Venezuela to expand its influence in Latin America. But Chavez is also using Iran to expand its influence in the Middle East and its good relationship with Syria and with the Palestinians, I think, is a case in point. So I'm sorry I gave a long answer to your question, but it depends from country to country. And for Venezuela, as I said, I think ideology and oil are the key elements, followed by investments that you so accurately described.
Another question, gentleman here?
Hi. My staff never thinks I need this. My name's Philip Myers. I'm chairman of Typhoon Security Technology, which does some things in counterterrorism. My question is particularly, from my experience, which is mostly in the Russian side, the way things sort of unfurled in the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think there was a large influence of the intelligence services separately as they sort of conceived a future of Russia as a power and the dysfunctionality of the party in the economic collapse. In the Iranian case, is there any sort of separate intelligence power center that could be helping to define the outcome and at the same time define what are useful alliances, extra eyes and ears with Chavez and his intelligence people?
I'll start on that, and then I'll turn
no,
to my
guy. Yeah.
So,
start
well,
it,
you know, it's an interesting question that we're following. It's, you know, it's happening under our feet now, so I don't think anything definitive could be said. Right now, the intelligence minister is changing, so we'll see how the community itself moves forward, the intelligence within Iran. But I think the more of the parallel that you might be looking for in the Iranian case is the Revolutionary Guards, because, and of course they have an intelligence function too. And there's a critical issue is going to be where they fall out on this. And I think as Dr. Milani has said, I mean, this is definitely a wait and see where we are now, but that has the potential of playing a similar role that you've identified from the Russian case. But this is just something to keep track of, but we can't possibly know that now. Now, for the relationship with Venezuela, I really do have to defer to my far more knowledgeable colleague if you want to say anything on that.
I took an economic course many, many years ago in California.
California, and my teacher, my professor, used to start his lecture every day by saying, "There ain't no such a thing as a free lunch." I was invited to come here, and I'm grateful to you to talk about Venezuela. Now, your question is, of course, demands another round trip ticket and and a hefty honorarium for me to answer. Thank you.
Time for one more question. Anyone have another question? Well, thank you all. Oh, there is. I'm sorry. I didn't see you there.
Hi, I'm Janine Keel from the Department of State, and I had a question for Dr. Milani. You mentioned during your remarks of something about one of Iran's goals being to establish retaliatory capability abroad. Wondering how you see that functioning in Latin America, if you see any Iranian activities that would represent an effort to establish a retaliatory capability in Latin America, Venezuela, or otherwise. And if you're not seeing anything conclusive, how you would maybe give us an example of where else we've seen more evidence of Iran establishing a retaliatory capability. Thank you.
Yes. In Latin America, to be perfectly honest with you, I have seen some circumstantial evidence. For example, the tribe that I was talking about, that they have converted to Shia Islam, they talk about all kinds of websites that Iran is sponsoring. They even talk about the fact that the Revolutionary Guards are have traveled to Venezuela, and through the support of the government there are supporting other guerrilla fighters or terrorists or whatever you want to call them. That's the extent of my information. What I do know is that capability, if I have to guess, and it's a guess, please understand, it's a guess. I don't have any evidence. Based on my little knowledge about what Iran is doing there, I would say, again, scale of A to D, Iranian capability in Latin America at this time is minus D. It's more of hot air than it's more of an agitation that, okay, you come to Iraq, you're next to us, we'll come to Latin America next to you. It's that kind of attitude. From a military point of view, from a retaliatory point of view, I don't think Iran really is taking this very seriously, not only because they don't have the capability there, they don't have the infrastructure, and they don't have the organization, and also because Latin American countries know that if they allow Iran to retaliate from their country against the U.S., they're going to be grilled, and they're not going to do that. Now, there are other places where you see that retaliatory capability quite visibly. The best example of it is in Lebanon, in Hezbollah. This has been the single greatest dividend Iran has had for its investments, because Iran now has the strategic depth at the heart of the Arab world and right next to Israel. In case of an attack on Iran, it is very likely that Iran is going to use it, the infrastructure it has built, the organization it has in Hezbollah, to attack the U.S.
the U.S. interests or U.S. allies, Israel. You see the same kind of retaliatory capability in, I would say, southern part of Iraq and throughout Iraq. You see the same kind of retaliatory capability in Herat region, where you Iran has the infrastructure, has the manpower. But in Latin America, I haven't seen any evidence yet that would alarm me. That's why I give it a D minus.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We've run out of time. Thank you all very much for having come. Please thank our panelists.